You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jack Devine had a long and storied career in the Central Intelligence Agency. He ran the United States covert war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, was in Chile when Allende fell, got tied up in the Iran-Contra affair, helped track down Pablo Escobar, and much more. Now he has written an account of his time at the agency and his feelings about spycraft in general in a memoir called Good Hunting, An American Spymaster Story. It's published by the Sarah Crichton Books imprint of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jack Devine back to our show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure, Leonard.
You write that you were inspired to join the CIA after reading the book The Invisible Government, which I thought was a critique of the agency. Well, I'm guessing you read it differently.
Well, I think there's a lesson in that. When people write books, it projects differently than you might think. I was teaching high school at the time in suburban Philadelphia, and I knew virtually nothing. In those days, there wasn't anything written about CIA. Today, you have two journalists for every newspaper covering CIA as a story. I read it and found what a fascinating life to live abroad and to be engaged in this wonderful Cold War in defense of democracy. So I took out a pen when we wrote with ink and wrote a letter to the CIA. And the next thing you know, I was brought into a series of training interviews and then training.
Was that easy?
I'm simplifying it. It was a polygraph.
Well, you took a polygraph to find out if you were sincere, whether you might be a mole?
Well, I think it's the first, whether or not you were a Soviet agent. But the first polygraph you take is a lifestyle. After that, there are counterintelligence ones, so they say. Lifestyle, back in those days, I mean, drugs, nobody used it other than maybe a hip drummer somewhere. So that would take you right out. They wanted to know my drinking habits as a lifeguard in North Wildwood. That was different then.
What was your early training, particularly in clandestine operations, like?
There's a terrific movie, at least the first half, called The Recruit, which captures pretty much the environment, even the location. And it's hands-on. We call it tradecraft. We learn from an experienced practitioner that served abroad. And you would learn how to develop relations with people, how to meet agents, how to, frankly, write reports. And then you moved into a paramilitary part, how to use explosives and weapons and how to jump out of planes.
And you blew up telephone poles as part of your paramilitary training.
Well,
why telephone poles?
Well, when you go through the demolition and the explosives, part of it is so you understand what's at stake. It's not that CIA operatives are out there doing it, but you're managing people to do it. But at that point, I had three children, and I was a prudent man, still think I am. So you have a detonating cord that burns at a certain rate. So I always added a few extra inches, which meant that my pole was going to blow up a few minutes later. Well, the instructors didn't have the same sense of humor that I did, and I ended up with a note saying, you know, you should never let this man near explosives. And the irony is, when I was in charge of the Afghan program running the task force in Washington, I was responsible for more explosives than anybody in the history of CIA up to that point.
So did you live by the rule that you had been taught, walk, don't run?
Well, that's a key part of it. The reason, you know, you cut it at a certain length and you're instructed to walk, because if you trip, then you'll be known as collateral damage.
You also had to cook an alligator in Panama. Why was that an important part of a training?
Well, we were sleeping out in the jungle, and they show you a great movie of propelling down a hill and walking through jungle, but they show you the summer version. They don't show you the rainy season, and it's just a mess. I mean, you're just living in, I had clothes that I kept dry in my sleeping arrangement. And in the morning, you know, I tilted it and the water ran in. So when it got around to cooking, the instructors provided what I would call native food, an alligator. When I say an alligator, it's probably a foot and a half long. Nobody knew how to cook it. I volunteered. I didn't know, but as a you know, a father of three at that point, I knew how to do some basic things. And so I threw it in a pot, threw some salt on it, threw in some rice, and everybody was hungry as could be. Nobody touched it. I've improved, I would add.
You write that by the time of your posting in the late 1969, the CIA had already matured greatly since its overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Iran in 1953 and the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. So what were the attitudes inside the agency about covert action at that time? Don't do what we did before?
Well, one of the curious things about covert action, most of the people that are in the operational, the spying directorate, if you will, really don't want to touch it. They really don't have any part of it. I would put myself in an exception category.
Despite the fact that I associate the CIA with covert action.
We do, because it makes good movies. I mean, meeting an agent in the middle of the night or putting a note in a rock and waiting for someone to come along is or sitting hours in surveillance vehicles doesn't provide the James Bond. That's the George Smiley of Le Carré. So when the CIA was set up, it had a charter, which it's a really fascinating one phrase, carry out those special activities as directed by the President of the United States. That's its only authority. But the CIA operatives really don't want to do it because they get burnt often. I happen to think it's an important tool, and that's what the book is about. Why covert action today is at least as relevant as it was then.
You mentioned Le Carré. Well, he was an MI5, was it?
That's correct.
So he gets it right?
The part that I like, not his later books, no offense to him, but I really enjoyed The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor, but it gets to the psychology of it, you know, the betrayal part. Now, in the book, I talk about Rick Ames, the mole that penetrated CIA, the CIA officer that worked for the Russians. And
you
who I
knew him
very
when
well.
You were in Rome.
That's right.
But this is later in the story. But still, did you suspect him at all?
No, actually, he was when I met him, he was a son of a CIA officer. He understood the business. I was a neophyte, believe me, when I walked in the building. I don't think anybody knew less about spying than I did. And when I first met him, he was we would argue because I would press the importance of covert action. He would stress the importance of counterintelligence, finding moles. I mean, what an irony. And as life would play it out, we hooked up 25 years later. And I talk about that.
After he had turned. But you think his earlier interest had nothing to do with him thinking about going in that direction?
Absolutely. I think he was at the early stages was a patriot and so on. But there are a whole set of reasons that, and this is going back to Le Carré and others, what makes someone betray? And we exchanged books. I don't know if we've talked about that, but I gave him a book called The Psychopathology of Leadership, and he gave me one by Eric Ambler, which was betrayal and spying. And we exchanged books. And the point about the psychology of leadership was that to some degree, there's a number of circumstances in our life that drive you somewhere. And I think it applied to Rick. Unknowingly, serendipitously, he was the type of person. He thought he was smarter than everybody. He was a narcissist and egocentric intellectually. He could care less about cars and clothes. And then he married a young woman and felt the pressures. But the thing that's very important when looking at all the factors, it might even be with Snowden, is he was lazy. So he only did what he was intellectually lazy. He only did what he wanted to do. So he felt the system didn't appreciate him, even though he didn't work hard.
My guest is Jack Devine, who spent 32 years at the CIA. He's written, with the help of Vernon Loeb, Good Hunting, an American Spy Master's Story. Well, since you bring up Snowden, you have written recently about him in Politico. I've never heard lazy applied to him. The man downloaded more information than anybody ever has. That doesn't sound like the work of a lazy man. He also, nobody ever said he did a bad job performance.
Well, I'm not sure about the latter, but let me just note two things about Rick Ames. Certain things he liked to do, he did. He didn't do other things. And I think we might be able to say the same about Snowden. He dropped out of school. He was not a top performer. I think he was shown the door by the agency and then was later picked up by NSA. There is no indication. But I did have an experience with Rick where he was working for the Russians. And the first day I met him when I was in Rome, I said, Rick, if you worked harder, you might be able to make something of yourself. And I guess he was thinking, how much harder do you want me to work on unloading documents for the Russians? And I think the same thing be true with Snowden.
Well, the NSA's internal auditor found that it violated federal privacy laws and exceeded its authority thousands of times per year. Two federal judges have ruled that the spying has violated the Fourth Amendment. One judge also said the U.S. government provided him with no evidence that Dragnet surveillance has prevented any imminent terror attack. Isn't there some value in knowing all about those programs?
I think it's the question of, let me take a couple points. One, when you join it, you sign a secrecy agreement. Okay, I did. That's meant to be taken seriously. Now, once you make a personal decision, then you're stepping out of that mode. What we don't talk about, we're talking here about the privacy in the United States, what was damaged immensely. We're talking about terrorism here. But the other part is our ability to collect internationally outside the United States. And no one seems to spend time on those billion-dollar programs that have been damaged. In the United States, when we scrape away these violations, I've yet to see something where they've really zeroed in on somebody illegally and looked at them rather than passing some third-level phone number. They go before the FISA court. There were 2,000 cases. You can't intercept anybody, either the FBI on a with the Teltap or NSA with satellites, without a court order. You have to go and get permission. It's not those agencies that are authorized of their own. Now, I do have some reservations about I've always been a strong supporter of the FISA, that it has to be reviewed. And the one thing that troubled me about it, that there wasn't enough, but seemingly we would have very good lawyers that make the case. Because I think there were 2,000 cases put to them and only a handful were not moved forward. So I think there needs to be guards to guard the guards.
Well, I don't want to get bogged down in this because you have an interesting story to tell in this book. But FISA court has rebuked the NSA for providing misleading information about its practices, which led to the FISA court pretty much okaying everything the NSA ever asked for.
Well, I think we'd have to, I mean, again, you're right. We don't want to get bogged down because I think we'd have to look at all of those cases, and I think they would stand by 1,999 of them.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Chile. We'll talk about Afghanistan.
Look forward to it.
Jack Devine is my guest. With Vernon Loeb, he has written Good Hunting, an American Spymaster's Story. It's published by the Sarah Crichton Books imprint of Farrah Straus and Giroux. Stay with us for more.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And we are back with Jack Devine. His book, Good Hunting, written with the help of Vernon Loeb, an American Spymaster story. It's published by the Sarah Crichton imprint of Farrah Straus and Giroux. How did you come to be posted to Chile? Was that before the election that got Allende elected?
I think it was, again, like so much of my life, and maybe it's all our lives, it was serendipitous. I happened to be an assistant to the chief of covert action for Latin America. And one day said, look, we need somebody in Chile. So he literally took me and brought me over to the Chile desk. And next thing I know, it turned into a task force, which means there's a special program. So I was working there during the election. And as a consequence, when a position opened in Chile, I was assigned there. It was a prestige position that you really wanted to be assigned there because there were two big programs at the time, one in Vietnam and one in Chile. So it was a choice assignment.
In a recent article in Public Affairs, you write, I can say with conviction that the CIA did not plot with the Chilean military to overthrow Allende in 1973. But hadn't the CIA been involved in an earlier coup attempt?
That's correct. And it was directed by the President of the United States. It's actually quite interesting and worth reading in the book. But if we could take ourselves back to the Cold War, Chile was looked at as the other red country that would balance out Cuba in a sandwich. So the Nixon administration was very, very concerned. And when Allende ran and got a plurality, a message went, well, first they talked to Dick Helms, the director, and then a message went to the field saying, we want to stop him, we want a military coup. The chief of station wrote back, a very experienced man, saying, the conditions are not right. This isn't going to happen. There's going to be bloodshed. And he was overridden. The White House came back and said, give it a try. And it turned into a disaster.
But then, although we weren't involved directly with the coup that did overthrow Allende, you say, against all odds, the Santiago station had helped create a climate for the coup without tainting the effort by becoming directly involved. Well, isn't creating a climate a pretty direct form of involvement?
I think it's
an invitation to a coup?
I think it's a question of how one weights things. What's very important, this is one of the key points that I wanted to stress, which is I won't say it was the day after, but certainly within 10 days after the failure to block Allende, a message was received, you will not plot with them. In other words, no plotting took place. There were no meetings between CIA and the military. The way we found out that there was a coup in September is I actually was contacted by a non-military person who had very strong ties with the Navy, and he said to me, or said to my wife and then passed to me, there's going to be a coup on September 11th. So between the failed coup and the fall of Allende, the CIA's effort was involved in supporting political parties, supporting interest groups that were the media. We thought it was important to preserve a free media. So, yes, we did that. And you can say that contributed to the environment, but if we were to sit down and I were to rank and weight, I would say to you first that Allende fell of his own weight. The economic policies and his cozying up to Castro, all of these things contributed. And if I would just add one last thing, what really pushed it over the top is the young officers in the military started to get unruly, and the military decided for that reason to intervene.
Well, you said that the CIA was concerned about Allende dismantling democracy in Chile. So why then didn't it stop General Pinochet from dismantling democracy when he seized power in 1973 and rather bloodily?
Yeah, I don't think anybody in the opposition, nor in CIA, nor in Washington, had any anticipation of what was coming. In fact, the conventional wisdom, which I had firsthand knowledge of, was that Pinochet did not have the steel to do this. That was the official CIA position then. So when he came to power, all of us in the opposition, if you will, felt, well, this he'll stabilize things in a reasonable Chilean way. They're not noted for violence. Their history is 150 years of nonviolent political activity.
And then they started rounding up people almost immediately.
No, it was incredible. It took us after a month, we realized that this had become something not in the character of the Chileans. And I wrote a memo. At that point, a very young officer, although I had a good deal more experience than anybody other than the chief in Chile at that point because I'd been there longer. And the chief asked me, well, give me some thoughts before you leave. And my thought was, let's use covert action to get rid of Pinochet.
You also write about how your wife and children almost got caught up in a Chilean military cleanup operation.
Well, that was one of my worst personal decisions. If you look over, I've made many mistakes in my career, and certainly. And, at one point, the country, you'd have to live there. There were explosions. The house next to me, they threw a bomb and missed, and it landed in my backyard. So you were living in high tension. I thought they were going to come through the door, and I knew I'd be in the embassy, so I said to my wife, why don't you – let me show you how to, you know, shoot down intruders, which she's a better shot than I am. But think about it. A woman by then with five children, I'm in the embassy, we're talking about this. We lost all sense of risk. I should have sent my family home.
How does one actually calculate what U.S. interests are, especially if it involves opposing a democratically elected government?
Well, I think this is one of the key points that I felt was misunderstood in a couple other folks, and that was the White House decides. Well, that's not the CIA's decision.
How was what happened in Chile all that different from the overthrow of Mossadegh years before?
I'm not sure I would make a distinction. They were both.
You said, well, the CIA had gone through a reevaluation in the interim, and here we are doing something very similar again. Also tried it with Lumumba.
No,
didn't
but
we?
I think the question is, are these CIA failures or are they policy failures? And I would say to you, putting in the Shah was an execution that was successful, but it was, you could say, maybe it was a flawed policy. And that's the problem. They're always look at the aftermath when you really need to look at who decided. And the decider is the president. There's no covert action that I know of in my 32 years that was not signed by the president of the United States. I don't know of any. I'd like to see someone step up and show me one.
Even Iran-Contra? Because Reagan washed his hands of it.
There was a presidential finding that authorized the sale of the weapons to the Iranians. I was in the middle of that. Where there was no signing and where the CIA was, as an institution, not involved, the illegality was providing the extra money that none of us knew about that ended up going to the Contras, which was against the Bolin Amendment.
Of course, during the Cold War, there were many proxy battles fought all over the world. You even say that Cuban intelligence once tried to gain access to your house through your Chilean housekeeper, Bernarda?
Yes, indeed.
What were they looking for? Do you know?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things you could do is plant an audio device. In other words, you could put it in my conference room. You could get her to pick up any papers I brought home. Now, what they're counting on is you have an undisciplined officer that does that. Our officers, and there are exceptions, I mean, we find it on both sides. You're looking for the crack. The Cuban doesn't know about that, but that's a fair game. I'm not angry at the Cubans for giving it a try.
Because
I would have done
the same thing,
sure.
My guest is Jack Devine. His book, Good Hunting, An American Spymaster Story, published by the Sarah Crichton imprint at Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Okay, you've been in Chile. How did you come to run the CIA's covert campaign in Afghanistan?
Well, rightfully or wrongly, my bosses at CIA thought I, by resisting the Iran-Contra, I think thought maybe I should be given an opportunity. So they put me in charge of the Afghan program at a time that the Reagan administration and the Democratic Congress in the form of Charlie Wilson were pushing very hard for a spike in the program.
The campaign is often referred to as Charlie Wilson's war. Do you think that's a totally accurate way to describe it? No. Did you like the
movie? I'm very fond of Charlie Wilson. He's a special person in the history of the agency, history of our country. We had dinner at Sparks, and as we all know in New York, that's where Castellano was shot down on the steps. Of course, that's where Charlie Wilson wants to have dinner. But I remember over dinner he said to me, Jack, I know you didn't like the book. You're going to hate the movie. But what he was talking about is it's a very good movie. It's a very good read. It just isn't history. The real story is that it was a bipartisan government program, Republican president, Democratic Congress, amply funded. And that makes for a boring movie and a boring story. But it's very important to get it right because the world doesn't change by having rogue people doing things.
You do describe going to a gun market in Pakistan's northwest frontier with Charlie Wilson. Wasn't that dangerous?
It indeed was. And Charlie was a risk taker. And enjoyed it. It was an adventure, a real he'd like to be Flashman. He even once sent me a note saying, I'm making you a sergeant in the Flashman Army.
Was that always helpful? I mean, no, a congressman inserting himself into this kind of operation?
Our chief out there would sweat bullets when he would go out by himself because we were afraid that Charlie would be wrapped up, wandering into Afghanistan when he wasn't supposed to. So it was indeed dangerous. The Pakistanis didn't want to take us there, but because they wanted Charlie on their side from support point of view, they took us, and it was quite a show.
In all, how many insurgents did the U.S. arm in Afghanistan?
I think our estimate and our supply train was based on the assumption of 120,000 fighters.
We bought weapons for use in Afghanistan from Egypt and China.
That's
Why
right.
those two countries?
Well, they have to be Soviet-made. In other words, when you're on the battlefield and you're fighting an army, an insurgency, you try to have weapons that are interchangeable. So if you overrun something, you use those weapons. And you wanted to conceal the U.S. hand as much as possible.
And nobody knew we were there, right?
Plausible doesn't mean believable denial.
Weren't you also involved in the decision to send Stinger missiles into Afghanistan?
Yes, and I think it changed history. It changed certainly the course of the war and may have been a major contributor, not the contributor, but a major one to the fall of the Soviet Union.
Well, you have written that your covert war in Afghanistan will always loom large, I'm quoting, large in my mind as the crowning accomplishment of my past work as an intelligence officer. But many people see the momentary victory in Afghanistan, getting the Soviets out, is only a momentary victory, in fact, almost a Pyrrhic victory, because what followed was rather terrible, including the actions of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and some of the other warlords who we had armed. And then later, many of the arms that we'd sent in wound up being used by the Taliban.
Yeah. First of all, I'd add, bringing down the Soviet Union is a major accomplishment, and you look at the real world. But this, I mean, in a broader sense, what I think is it's interesting. Charlie Wilson and I actually talked about continuing support after the Russians left, and many of my colleagues felt that it would serve no useful purpose. Frankly, when I look back in writing the book, I think I was wrong. I think it was not a, it would not have been a good idea to stay there. And I have reservations about I was 100% behind the going in and bringing down the Taliban. I've had reservations about trying to build a democratic state there. The Afghanis must decide themselves and struggle among themselves to decide what type of future they want.
So should we have predicted the Taliban?
Well, a lot of folks have forgotten that once the Russians left, the government didn't fall. It stayed for 3 years. And it's relevant today because the Russians continued to support them with materiel. They fell the minute when the Russians stopped. We need to think about that with the post-Karzai administration.
After your Afghan posting, you went to Rome. Was that a desirable posting?
It was believed to be, but... and I enjoyed it. Who doesn't like Rome? Okay, I love Italian food too much.
And you got you had the opportunity to meet the Pope.
That was a tricky situation.
What did he ask you?
Yeah. I had a private audience with him. It was one of those things I wanted to do. And he caught me flat-footed momentarily. He asked me, where do I work? And I have the choice of failing my next polygraph by blowing my cover or lying to the Pope. And I got a lucky break, a moment of inspiration. I simply said, well, Your Holiness, I work at the U.S. Embassy. And I thought he was like, yeah, I get the U.S. Embassy. But so I didn't lie to the Pope, and I didn't break my cover.
And he didn't pursue it. He didn't do
no,
a follow-up.
No.
You say that the CIA has run influence operations in Italy it ran it in 48 to stop a communist parliamentary takeover. Is it still seen in a positive light, or have recent anti-American attitudes changed things?
What's fascinating in my career is you often have a public posture by governments and people and a private one. And it never ceases to amaze me how much positive feeling there is. And in Italy, I remember the chief of police I mean, we have not been involved in Italian elections since 48 or in their political system. But most of the senior Italians think we have extraordinary influence. And he just made a habit of walking me around so his friends could see that we were still in good terms, just in case I had more influence than I really had.
Before you left the agency, you also played a role in counter-narcotics. So how important was CIA input into capturing the drug lord Pablo Escobar?
Well, I think there's the whole history of combating drugs, and I think the CIA played a huge part. I mean, the history of cooperating with foreign governments, you can't do things like terrorism, proliferation, and narcotics without foreign governments. And in my early days, you gave the foreign governments the absolute minimum. And we got to narcotics, and remember, it was the number one target then. There was a fundamental decision made to give them serious capabilities. So the CIA gave them capabilities to do connectivity analysis, to intercept telephones. So we really beefed up the intelligence part, and that was against the entire Colombian trafficking unit and was a huge contributor to nailing down Pablo Escobar.
Jack Devine is a 32-year veteran of Central Intelligence Agency. He served at as the CIA's top spymaster at the top of his career, the head of the CIA's operations outside the United States, in which capacity he had supervisory authority over thousands of CIA employees involved in sensitive missions throughout the world. These days, he has his own company, the Arkin Group, and he's written a memoir called Good Hunting with the help of Vernon Loeb, an American spymaster story, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was great being here, Leonard.